welcome Dr. Gary Schiff to our refectory.
Thank you for that beautiful rendition of Cold and Dre. Touch my heart. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to be back here in this warm, safe space, dry, for the umpteenth time. See so many friends and colleagues. Must be doing something right. Invited back again. In the past, we've had fun discussing, debating, and even laughing about many topics. But today, I'm going to talk about something deadly serious. Literally, anti-Semitism. While the term was first coined in the mid-19th century by a German writer named Wilhelm Marr, is relatively new, the idea and practice, the world's oldest hatred, simply means, anti-Semitism means, hatred of Jews and of all things Jewish. It has no reference to other Semites. I'm sure you were all shocked by the brutal murder in Pittsburgh of 11 elderly Jews, including a 97-year-old woman. There's got to be a special place in hell for someone who assassinates a 97-year-old woman. In their synagogue on Shabbat to worship, of all things, last October by a gunman with an automatic rifle shouting, "All Jews must die." How could this occur? Are we past all that 80 years after Kristallnacht? What about never again? In the wake of this tragedy, many individual non-Jews, churches, organizations, officials, etc., express their condolences and solidarity with the Jewish community, with their Jewish friends and neighbors, which were greatly appreciated, I assure you. But for many Jews, including this one, the effect was even more profound, chilling, and numbing. No matter what their personal variation of Judaism, or how well integrated they may be into their society, this, the worst mass murder in U.S. Jewish history, rekindled that deeply buried ember within the Jewish soul of unease, of insecurity, of fear based on a long, bitter experience, historical. Are they starting to kill Jews again? One of our Havura members, a person with a lifelong commitment to social justice, reacted to the news with just a telling shrug, as if to say, "So what else is new? We've seen it all before." This is not to say that this tragic event, the result of the actions of a single sicko, is a one-off. Anti-Semitism is as American as apple pie. It has always been around. Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, Father Coughlin, the KKK, George Lincoln Rockwell, Louis Farrakhan, etc., etc., were not unique. Here in Maryland, Jews were not allowed to even vote until 1826, when a special law called the Jew Bill was passed, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence. Many of us, if you check, probably still have restricted covenants in the deeds to our homes, which were only invalidated in the 1960s, which prohibit Jewish ownership, Black ownership, or Asian ownership of those homes. I was shocked when I first came down here and closed on my first house to read. And technically speaking, I was not allowed to own my house. We perhaps had naively thought that those days were gone, were over, or at least were waning. But the sharp rise in anti-Semitic acts of late is very troubling. It dwarfs the number of acts of hate against all other minorities in the United States combined. Combined. Yet it was the Pitzer atrocity that has brought it into broader, sharper focus. Anti-Semitism is also rampant all across Europe, both East and Western Europe, and in the Middle East, and is often incited or abetted by governments or political movements. So what explains this seemingly endless historical pattern of hostility towards Jews? Endless. What factors can possibly have linked such disparate civilizations as the ancient Egyptians, Greeks and Romans, pagans all, as well as Christians and Muslims, Catholics and Protestants, Sunni and Shia, Crusaders and Reformers, fascists and Nazis, enlightened intellectuals like Voltaire and more traditionalist thinkers, secularists and religionists, communists like Karl Marx, who himself was the grandson of two rabbis, who considered Jews capitalists, and nationalists like Hitler, who saw Jews as communists, both, to the point where their persecution, expulsion and despoliation, even genocide, becomes the answer to a nation's, if not the world's, problems. What unites all these civilizations? Surely there have been other people subject to genocide, like the Armenians in Turkey during World War I. But no less an expert on the subject than Hitler himself, when asked what the world might say about his final solution to the Jewish problem, Jewish question, replied, "Who even remembers the Armenians?" Other ethnic cleansings, however horrific, have been episodic, historically and geographically limited. But in the case of the Jews, they have persisted, growing more systematic and destructive. From biblical times, when Jews were not only enslaved in Egypt, but think about it, were also subject to genocide. Throwing the male children into the Nile is genocide. To the Crusades, the Inquisition, the Holocaust, and current threats from Islamic powers, be they Arabs or Iranians, to destroy the state of Israel with its 6 million Jews, under the guise of anti-Semitism, this ominous threat has never been far below the surface. Why? Is it just because people don't understand or they dislike the other, the stranger, the foreigner, those who don't look or behave like us? You hear this often. If people could learn and understand more about each other, would all this antagonism fade away? Well, it is true that historically Jews have been the quintessential stranger. For 2,000 years until very modern times, they were the only sizable non-Christian minority in Europe, or in Christendom. It defines the community. If you're not Christian, you're not part of Christendom. They lived outside of what sociologists call the community of concern, not really part of us, the objects of curiosity and begrudging tolerance at best, of fear, suspicion, jealousy, and hatred at worst. But this general antipathy towards strangers, which our Bible rails against, because you too were strangers in the land of Egypt, this social ethnic explanation, anti-Semitism, can't be the whole answer. After all, there have been other despised minorities in history who were persecuted, like early Christians in the Roman Empire, while Irish immigrants in the United States, who came to be accepted eventually into or even dominate mainstream culture. If this theory of socio-ethnic conflict were correct, that once the Jews were finally, if not grudgingly, granted true citizenship, which took place first in France in 1791, and then they became more broadly educated and assimilated into society, anti-Semitism, by this definition, would have disappeared there, right? N'est-ce pas? But in fact, France became the locus of anti-Semitism in the 19th century, with anti-Jewish books, newspapers, even political parties appearing, followed by the infamous Dreyfus trial of the 1890s, the pro-Nazi Vichy government in the 1940s, and the many anti-Jewish acts committed there of late. I just clipped this out of the Wall Street Journal this week, which says, anti-Semitic acts spreading like poison in France. The cover of the Wall Street Journal this week had a picture of the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, visiting a cemetery in Alsace that had been desecrated. Okay. Similar, if not worse, manifestations of Jew hatred are seen elsewhere in Western and Central Europe, despite the large-scale acculturation of many of its Jews. Jews in Germany, Jews in Hungary were highly acculturated, in some cases indistinguishable from local residents, and even more so Jews in more conservative Eastern Europe. So why can help explain this scourge? The Nazis, building on ancient Teutonic and other fuzzy mythologies, with a generous dollop of social Darwinism and American-based eugenics and race laws, the United States was really the only country in the world and at the time who had state, local, and federal laws based on race, came up with a new twist, a racial version of anti-Semitism, which holds that the world is ordered into a racial hierarchy, with tall, white, Nordic, good-looking, blonde, blue-eyed Aryans, like Himmler, Goebbels, perhaps, as the elite, Slavs and other Europeans and non-Europeans below them, and last but not least, the demonized, manipulative subhuman Jews, who must be destroyed to prevent their planned takeover of the world. While this racial mumbo jumbo is largely discredited today, there are still many true believers, from the Charlottesville marchers and David Dukes to their ideological comrades in Europe and the Middle East, where, as I saw on the bookstalls in Cairo, Mein Kampf in Arabic is still a bestseller. Would you believe? Meanwhile, the so-called inferior Jewish race, a mere 14 million or so of us left, continues to garner about one quarter of all Nobel Prizes, be it in the sciences and medicine or economics and literature. And given our own desire for self-preservation and the antipathy of the outside world, it has ironically remained one of the more genetically pure groups than most. Don't know if any of you watched Professor Henry Louis Gates' show about genealogy that's on once a week. His distinguished guest on his program, Finding Your Roots show, his Jewish guests, show that they seem to be genetically 98 to 99% Jewish. One recent guest was Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, who turned out to be 99.7% Ashkenazi Jewish, okay? More than most, 99.7. I'm sure mine was at least as high. The missing 1 or 2% may be attributable to statistical anomalies, the occasional convert into Judaism, some ancestors' indiscretion, which we won't mention, or the widespread rape of Jewish women during pogroms, which is very rarely mentioned, but which frequently happened. Okay, but many Jews like Sheryl Sandberg, are far more pure in their descent than many numbers. In addition to their racial anti-Semitism, the Nazis also used other tried and true, but equally fallacious tropes about Jews. One of these old reliables, now reappearing in American political circles, like Representative Ilhan Omar, is the economic one, where Jews are inherently dishonest, avaricious when it comes to money. It's all about the Benjamins, baby, as she said just about 2 weeks ago. Ironically, being excluded not only from society but the economy as well, Jews have long had to improvise new and creative ways to eke out a living. For much of the history in Europe, Jews were systematically prohibited from owning land, then the principal economic asset. Likewise, they were banned from most other non-agricultural occupations, barred from artisans' guilds, merchants' associations, universities, etc. So if they could not produce new items, any new items, could not sell them, for example, they learned how to deal in used merchandise, clothing, furniture, junk, what today we call recycling. And when the church forbade Christians to lend money at interest, Jews amended their own laws prohibiting the practice to adjust to this new area of opportunity. So while some Jews managed to attain a modicum of material success, that often engendered envy. Many remained poor as new restrictions were piled on to where they could or could not live. That's the origins of ghettos. You can live here, but not there. What occupations they could or could not engage in. My father's mother's huge family is still named Feinzeug, which means fine clothes or fine cloth, because under Frederick the Great's list of occupations that Jews could occupy, even though textiles was an ancient Jewish occupation, they could only engage in the creation of fine cloth, expensive clothing and cloth, because the common cloth that was worn by 99% of the people was produced by the guilds and the merchants' associations. So they were excluded from that. So the name still is Feinzeug, fine cloth, because that was the only thing. What additional taxes they had to pay? Jews in Europe had to pay a special tax on candles, because they knew that Jews lit candles on Friday night, so they would have to buy them, and so they had to do a special tax on candles. Anything they could think of. Even if, when, and how many of them could marry. The reason that there was a flurry of Jewish immigration to the United States in the 1840s was not only because of the revolution in 1848, which failed and many Jews came here, but because laws in much of Germany were that only one child per family could marry, usually the oldest child. So if you had six children, they had to leave if they ever wanted to get married. People don't know these things, but this was the reality of being a Jew in Europe. So, and whatever wealth they may have accumulated through hard work and creativity, all could disappear in the blink of an eye with the latest expulsion and confiscation order. Whether it was Spain and Portugal in the 1490s, Jews had to leave penniless, or Germany in the 1930s, you were never sure of what you wanted. Yet, Jews are still the most philanthropic group in America. Mr. Bloomberg recently donated $1.8 billion to Johns Hopkins, on top of the buildings named for him in the part. I don't hear that from certain other would-be billionaires, right, who claim to be philanthropic. Besides the ever-popular socioeconomic, racial, and economic sources of anti-Semitism, the religious aspects were most deeply rooted and widespread, something of particular aspect, particular interest to you, you use. In ancient and not-so-ancient pagan societies, polytheism and anthropomorphism of rival all-too-human-like gods allowed a much more moral leeway for both hedonistic and repressive cultures to thrive than the strict monotheism and its ethical absolutes that Jews insisted on. So orgies and gladiator fights were much more fun than the Ten Commandments, and when, unless you happen to be a gladiator, in which case it wasn't that much fun. With the emergence of Christianity and later Islam from their Jewish roots, and its adoption of the official as the official religion of the Roman Empire, the Jews, who stubbornly resisted these supersessionist upstarts, once again found them the objects of others' ire. Why don't those damn Jews accept our revisions of their faith already? And when the bulk of Christians, present company excluded, began to enshrine what Jews considered something less than strictly monotheism, like dualism, Trinitarianism, the deification of, of human figures, that irritation morphed into outright hostility. Jews were now subject to all manner of anti-Christian screeds, from deicide to the use of Christian blood in the baking of matzah, to the desecration of the host, calumnies that often led to mass violence, and which are still believed in many places. Protestant Reformation had no salutary effect either. These deeply ingrained religious prejudices against Jews, once melded with other varieties that I already mentioned and harnessed to modern technologies, especially became especially toxic in the mid-20th century and still bubble up from below in our own times as in Pittsburgh. So yes, anti-Semitism different from, much older than, more profound, more universal, and enduring than any other of the heinous forms of bigotry the world knows. And invariably, it is the augury of worse things to come. Anti-Semitism has sometimes been adopted by other minorities as a tool for their predilections, or as a means to curry favor with their own persecutors, as many Holocaust collaborators did. We, Hungarians, Poles, will persecute the Jews or cooperate in your persecution or do it on our own in order that you'll stay off our case. It has even been used readily by some self-aggrandizing, often German Jews, as a means to distinguish themselves from those other Jews, Eastern or Jews. That never works. We all end up on the same. Anti-Semitism still exists in places where few Jews survive, Poland, and even in places where Jews really never lived, Japan. Ironically, it has a life of its own, separate and apart from reality. It is a reality. So what, if anything, can be done about it? It was precisely the anti-Semitism surrounding the Dreyfus trial in Paris that he witnessed as a journalist that motivated an assimilated Jew named Theodor Herzl, drawing upon deep Jewish beliefs and history, to advocate for a Jewish state by writing a book by that exact name in 1896. This Zionist option has emerged into the State of Israel, which is self constantly subject to anti-Semitic hostility from all sides, at least provides a concrete form of self-protection. As for the rest of us Jews, like here in the United States, I am less sanguine. I recently reread Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, his 2004 novel about growing up in Newark, New Jersey in the 30s and 40s. In it, Lindbergh gets elected president with all the familiar Nazi-like ramifications for America's Jews ensuing. It is really chilling, especially day. While I have not given up on educational efforts and community relations, I think that their effect is limited to those who are predisposed to lend a sympathetic ear or are at least neutral. The others, I'm afraid, are law schools. Every legal means should be exercised. People of goodwill should speak up more, whether in private and public, in the media, online, wherever. Every legal means should be exercised to counter anti-Semitic manifestations. No one should get off scot-free shouting Heil Hitler in a packed theater in Baltimore during a production of Fiddler on the Roof, as just happened a month or two ago. No one should get up and shout Heil Hitler at a faculty meeting, as happened at a college in Connecticut just a few months ago. As Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes opined over a century ago, shouting fire or any other incendiary words in a crowded theater, exact same analogy, where panic and death could result, is not protected by our constitutional right of free speech, any more than the untrammeled ability to acquire, brandish, and employ deadly weapons everywhere is a constitutional right. That is not free speech. It is hate speech and incitement and should be prosecuted accordingly. Strong state and local laws, such as have been adopted in Pittsburgh about guns recently, shouldn't be adopted generally. Those politicians of the left or the right who increasingly make hostile remarks about Jews need to be called out and forced out of public life. People, even young people, who desecrate Jewish facilities or harass Jews should be apprehended and appropriately punished. Neither youthful indiscretion nor alcohol, drugs, ignorance, nor any other excuse is valid. Extensive education at all levels on the effects of prejudice, anti-Semitism, and the Holocaust, which a recent survey found that most American adults know very, very little about, psychological counseling, and community service in Jewish institutions. Clean bedpans in a Jewish old age home should be all required. While I'm not as naive so as to think such actions will eliminate anti-Semitism, nor will armed guards everywhere prevent all attacks, nevertheless, as the Talmud teaches, it is not incumbent upon you to finish the job, but neither are you free to desist from it. Thank you. I'll be glad to take some of your comments and questions, but I would first like you to stand as I read and then chant the memorial prayer for those 11 martyred Jews in Pittsburgh.